Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. This is Getting It Done, and as always, I am your host, Dr. Walter Dean. I had planned on having a fantastic show for you today, and let's see if you might find this very interesting. We're going to be having as a guest on the show the great, the fantastic Miles Davis, and we'll be featuring all about his life and how he sounded and things about him that hopefully, if you didn't know, you'll have an opportunity to find out. I was also thought that we might have a guest on my show, Berlin Dean. I don't see him appearing on the callers list as of yet, so I'm going to go ahead and get started with what I'm attempting to do, and that is deal with the great, none other than the great, Miles Davis. Let's listen up.
Miles Davis, Miles Dewey Davis III, May 26, 1926, September 28, 1991, was an American jazz trumpeter, band leader, and composer. He is among the most influential and acclaimed figures in the history of jazz and 20th century music. Davis adopted a variety of musical directions in his five-decade career, which kept him at the forefront of a number of major stylistic developments in jazz. Born and raised in Illinois, Davis left his studies at the Juilliard School in New York City and made his professional debut as a member of saxophonist Charlie Parker's bebop quintet from 1944 to 1948. Shortly after, he recorded the birth of the Cool Sessions for Capitol Records, which were instrumental to the development of cool jazz. In the early 1950s, Davis recorded some of the earliest hard bop music while on Prestige Records, but did so haphazardly due to a heroin addiction. After a widely acclaimed comeback performance at the Newport Jazz Festival in 1955, he signed a long-term contract with Columbia Records and recorded the 1957 album Roundabout Midnight. It was his first work with saxophonist John Coltrane and bassist Paul Chambers, key members of the sextet he led into the early 1960s. During this period, he alternated between orchestral jazz collaborations with arranger Gil Evans, such as the Spanish music-influenced Sketches of Spain, 1960, and band recordings, such as Milestones, 1958, and Kind of Blue, 1959. The latter recording remains one of the most popular jazz albums of all time, having sold over 4 million copies in the U.S. Davis made several lineup changes while recording Someday My Prince Will Come, 1961, his 1961 Black Hawk Concerts, and Seven Steps to Heaven, 1961.
Wow, that's a trip. It's very interesting to see when people are talking about something, how that happens to sort of dissipate. Let's see if I can get that back.
63, another mainstream success that introduced bassist Ron Carter, pianist Herbie Hancock, and drummer Tony Williams. After adding saxophonist Wayne Shorter to his new quintet in 1964, Davis led them on a series of more abstract recordings often composed by the band members, helping pioneer the post-bop genre with albums such as ESP, 1965, and Miles Smiles, 1967, before transitioning into his electric period. During the 1970s, he radically experimented with rock, funk, African rhythms, emerging electronic music technology, and an ever-changing lineup of musicians, including keyboardist Joe Zawinul, drummer Al Foster, and guitarist John McLaughlin. In this period, beginning with Davis' 1969 studio album In a Silent Way and concluding with the 1975 concert recording Agartha, was the most controversial in his career, alienating and challenging many in jazz's millennium selling 1970 record Beaches Brew helped spark a resurgence in the genre's commercial popularity with jazz fusion as the decade progressed. After a five-year retirement due to poor health, Davis resumed his career in the 1980s, employing younger musicians and pop music sounds on albums such as The Man with a Horn, 1981, and Tutu, 1986. Critics were generally unreceptive, but the decade garnered the trumpeter his highest level of commercial recognition. He performed sold-out concerts worldwide while branching out into visual arts, film, and television work. Before his death in 1991 from the combined effects of a stroke, pneumonia, and respiratory failure. In 2006, Davis was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, which recognized him as one of the key figures in the history of jazz. Rolling Stone described him as the most revered jazz trumpeter of all time, not to mention one of the most important musicians of the 20th century. While Gerald Early called him inarguably one of the most influential and innovative musicians of that period. Early life. Miles Dewey Davis III was born on May 26, 1926 to an affluent African-American family in Alton, Illinois, 15 miles north of St. Louis. He had an older sister, Dorothy May, B. 1925, and a younger brother, Vernon, B. 1929. His mother, Cleona May, Minnie Henry, of Arkansas, was a music teacher and violinist, and his father, Miles Dewey Davis II, also of Arkansas, was a dentist. They owned a 200-acre estate near Pine Bluff, Arkansas, that housed a profitable pig farm where Davis and his siblings would ride horses, fish, and hunt. In 1927, the family moved to East St. Louis, Illinois, living on the second floor of a commercial building in a predominantly white neighborhood behind a dental office. From 1932 to 1934, Davis attended John Robinson Elementary School, an all-black institution, followed by Crispus Attucks School, where he performed well in mathematics, music, and sports. As a youngster, Davis developed his earliest appreciation for music, citing the blues, big bands, and gospel music. The house at 1701 Kansas Avenue in East St. Louis, Illinois, where Davis lived from 1939 to 1944. In 1935, Davis received his first trumpet as a gift from John Eubanks, a friend of his father, and later took weekly lessons with his father's patient, teacher and musician Elwood Buchanan. His mother objected to the choice of instrument as she preferred her son take up the violin. Against the fashion of the time, Buchanan stressed the importance of playing without vibrato and encouraged him to adopt a more clear, mid-range tone. Davis claimed he would slap his knuckles every time he started using heavy vibrato. Davis would carry his clear signature tone throughout his career. He once remarked on its importance to him, saying, "I prefer a round sound with no attitude in it, like a round voice with not too much tremolo and not too much bass. Just right in the middle. If I can't get that sound, I can't play anything." In 1939, the family moved to 1701 Kansas Avenue in East St. Louis. For his 13th birthday that year, Davis' father bought his
You don't seem like much of church going man, Mr. Bowden.
Well, music, I thought. I see you already do the folks. And I know how to sell what you got.
How the band supposed to make more money if you got to pay you?
I put you in front of a white horse. They won't have to wreck in the top. This is America, baby. How far you think you're gonna get? I'm gonna put a plate on this.
Shut him down.
This world is so. And they will destroy each other.
To summon a new trumpet, and Davis began to play in local bands, earning as much as $85 a week. Around this time, Davis took additional trumpet lessons from Joseph Gustak, principal trumpeter of the St. Louis Symphony Orchestra. In 1941, the 15-year-old Davis began at East St. Louis Lincoln High School, where he joined the school's marching band directed by Buchanan and entered music competitions. Davis claimed the contests he did not win were largely due to prejudice over his race, but said that such experiences made him a better musician. Davis proceeded to improve his understanding of music after a drummer he played with around this time suggested Davis play a passage from the previous night, yet Davis was unable to comprehend what he meant. That hit me. I went and got everything, every book I could get to learn about theory. It was at Lincoln High where Davis met his first girlfriend, Irene Berth, later Coughlin. Davis had formed his own group by this time, performing in various local venues such as Elks Club and Huff's Bear Garden with hits such as In the Mood by Glenn Miller. A portion of his earnings went towards his sister's education at Fisk University. Davis also befriended trumpeter Clark Terry, who also suggested he play without vibrato and perform together in various capacities for several years. In 1943, at Buchanan's recommendation and Coffin's persuasion, Davis filled a vacant spot on Eddie Randall's Rimboogie Orchestra, also known as the Blue Devils, and eventually became its musical director, which involved the scheduling of rehearsals and hiring newcomers. Davis later acknowledged his tenure as one of the most important of his career. During this time, Sonny Stitt tried to persuade him to join the Tiny Bradshaw Band, then passing through town, but Davis' mother insisted that he finish his final year of high school before he could tour. He said, "I didn't talk to her for 2 weeks. And I didn't go with the band either." In January 1944, Davis finished his studies at East St. Louis Lincoln High School and graduated in absentia in June. The following month, Coffin gave birth to a daughter, Cheryl. In July 1944, Billy Eckstein and his big band, which featured Dizzy Gillespie, Charlie Parker, and Art Blakey, visited St. Louis for a series of performances. They needed a stand-in after third trumpeter Buddy Anderson was too ill to attend. They invited Davis, who accepted and played with the group for 2 weeks at Club Riviera. The experience was a profound one for Davis, after which he had to be in New York, where the action was. His mother wanted him to continue with his education and study the piano or violin at Fisk University with his sister, but Davis declined. Career 1944 to 1948, New York City and the bebop years. Tommy Potter, Charlie Parker, Miles Davis, Duke Tobin, Max Roach, August 1947. In September 1944, Davis accepted his father's idea of studying at the Institute of Musical Arts, later known as the Juilliard School. In New York City, Davis passed his audition and attended classes in music theory, piano and dictation, but soon lost focus and spent much of his time in the club scene and locating Parker, despite being advised against doing so by several people he met in his search, including Coleman Hawkins. After finally locating his idol, Davis became one of the cadre of musicians who held nightly jam sessions at two Harlem nightclubs, Minton's Playhouse and Monroe's. The group included many of the future leaders of the bebop revolution, such as Fats Navarro, Freddie Webster, and J.J. Johnson. Established musicians including Thelonious Monk and Kenny Clarke were also regular participants. In December 1944, Davis reunited with Coffin and their daughter when they relocated to New York City, the three living in the same building as Parker, who eventually became a roommate. In mid-1945, Davis failed to register for the year's autumn term of study at Juilliard and dropped out after three semesters as he wished to commit to jazz performance full-time. His father advised his son to avoid sounding like everyone else and find his own style, yet remained supportive and continued to send over money until Davis could earn enough on his own. Davis later criticized the school's classes for centering too much on the classical European and white repertoire, but credited the institution for his education in music theory and improving his trumpet playing technique. Davis began playing professionally, performing in several 52nd Street clubs with Hawkins and Eddie Lockjaw Davis, and, on April 24, 1945, recorded his first sessions in a recording studio as part of Herbie Fields' group with Henry Rubber Leaks Williams, his first of many as a sideman. Davis' first recording as leader came in 1946 with an occasional group named the Miles Davis Sextet plus Earl Coleman and Anne Hathaway, one of the rare occasions when Davis is heard accompanying singers. Davis would not record another session as leader until 1947. Davis on piano with Howard McGee, trumpet, Joe Albany, pianist, standing, and Rick Fliegel, guitarist, smoking, September 1947. After Gillespie split from Parker's quintet in 1945, Davis took his place in October and the group performed the residency at various clubs on 52nd Street. On November 26th, Davis took part in several recording sessions as part of Parker's group Reboppers that also involved Gillespie and Roach, displaying hints of the style he would become known for. During a take of Parker's signature song Now's the Time, Davis takes a melodic solo, whose unbop-like quality anticipates the cool jazz period that followed. In 1946, Davis played in a big and small band led by Benny Carter in St. Louis and travels with the group for performances in California. During his time on the West Coast, Davis performed with Parker, who had also traveled there with Gillespie. 34. During a stop in Los Angeles, Parker suffered from a nervous breakdown that landed him in hospital for several months, leaving Davis stranded. Davis secured a spot on Eckstein's California tour, which eventually brought him back to New York City in late 1946. In March 1946, Davis played in studio sessions with Parker and began a collaboration with bassist Charles Mingus that summer, during which Coffin gives birth to Davis' second child, Gregory, in East St. Louis before reuniting with Davis in New York City the following year. Davis noted that by this time I was still so much into the music that I was even ignoring Irene, and was drinking and doing cocaine. Following the breakup of Eckstein's band in early 1947, Davis secured work by playing in a big band led by Gillespie and Illinois Yawcake, and joining a new quintet led by Parker in April that also included Roach. Together they performed led with Duke Jordan and Tommy Potter for much of the year, including several studio sessions. In one session in May, Davis penned the tune Cheryl, named after his daughter. Davis' first session as a leader followed in August 1947, playing as the Miles Davis All-Stars that included Parker, pianist John Lewis, and bassist Nelson Boyd. Together they recorded Milestones, Half Nelson, and Sipping Bells. After touring Chicago and Detroit with Parker's quintet, Davis returned to New York City in March 1948 and joined the jazz at the Philharmonic tour, which included a stop in St. Louis on April 30th. 1948 to 1950, Miles Davis, Nonet, and Birth of the Cool. In August 1948. Davis declined an offer to join Duke Ellington's orchestra as he had entered rehearsals with a new, nine-piece band with pianist and arranger Gil Evans and baritone saxophonist Jerry Mulligan, taking an active role that soon became his own project. Evan's Manhattan apartment had become a meeting place for several young musicians and composers such as Davis, Roach, Lewis, and Mulligan, who were unhappy with the increasingly virtuoso instrumental techniques that dominated the bebop scene, has led to the formation of the Miles Davis Nonet, which featured a more unusual lineup with a French horn and tuba. The objective was to achieve a sound similar to the human voice through carefully arranged compositions and by emphasizing a relaxed, melodic approach to the improvisations. In September, the band completed their solo engagement as the openers for Count Basie at the Royal Roost for 2 weeks. Davis had to persuade the venue's manager to award the advertising sign as Miles Davis Nonet. Arrangements by Gil Evans, John Lewis, and Jerry Mulligan. He prevailed only with the help of Monte Kay, the club's artistic director. Davis rejoined Parker's quintet soon after, but relationships within the quintet were growing tense, mainly due to Parker's erratic behavior caused by his drug addiction. 34. Early into his tenure with Parker, Davis had adopted a lifestyle of drug abstinence, a vegetarian diet, and spoke of the benefits of water and juice. Matters worsened when Davis and Roach objected to the addition of pianist Duke Jordan and preferred to hire Bud Powell. The situation culminated in December 1948 when Davis quit, claiming he was not being paid. Davis' split from Parker marked the beginning of a period when he worked mainly as a freelancer and sideman in some of the most important combos in the New York City jazz scene. His Nonet remained active until the end of 1949. After landing a recording deal with Capitol Records, they recorded sessions in January and April 1949, including the singles Move and Multiplicity, which sold little but became influential pieces of music on the cooler West Coast style of jazz. The lineup changed throughout the year and included the additions of tuba player Bill Barber, alto saxophonist Lee Konitz, who had been preferred to Sonny Stitt's style was considered too bop-oriented, pianist Al Haig, trombone players Mike Swerin with Kai Winding, French horn players Junior Collins with Sandy Finkelstein and Gunther Schuller, and bassists Al McKibben and Joe Schumann. One track featured singer Kenny Hanged. The presence of white musicians in the group angered some black players, many of whom were unemployed at the time, yet Davis rebuffed their criticisms. Recording sessions with the Nonet for Capitol Records continued until April 1950. Much of it remained unreleased until the issue of Birth of the Cool, 1957, its name given to the cool jazz movement that had developed in the musical direction the group had taken. In May 1949, Davis performed with the Tad Dameron Quintet with Kenny Clarke and James Moody at the Paris International Jazz Festival, his first trip abroad. Davis took a strong liking for Paris and its cultural environment, where black jazz musicians and people of color in general were better respected than in America. The trip, he described, changed the way I looked at things forever. During his time there, Davis began a love affair with singer and actress Julia Greco, which lasted for several years. 1949 to 1955, hard bop and the blue period, the early 1950s was a period of great difficulty for Davis. Upon his return from Paris in mid-1949, he became depressed and could only secure little amounts of work, which included a short engagement with Powell in October and guest spots in New York City, Chicago, and Detroit until January 1950. To make matters worse, Davis was falling behind in hotel rent and numerous attempts were made to repossess his car. His heroin use became an expensive addition, and Davis, yet to reach 24 years old, lost my sense of discipline, lost my sense of control over my life, and started to drift in August 1950 during a family trip to East St. Louis and Chicago in an attempt to improve their fortunes. Coffin gave birth to Davis' second son, Miles IV, in Chicago. The latter was where Davis befriended boxer Johnny Bratton and began a strong interest in the sport. Soon after, Davis left Coffin and his three children in New York City in the hands of his friend and jazz singer Betty Carter, who allowed his family to move in with her and looked after the children. Davis remained thankful to Carter for the rest of his life. Davis then toured with Eckstein and Billie Holiday in their backing bands, during which he was arrested for heroin possession in Los Angeles. The story was reported in Downbeat magazine, which caused a further reduction of work for Davis, though he was acquitted weeks later. In January 1951, Davis' fortunes improved when he secured a one-year recording contract with Prestige Records, an independent jazz label, after owner Bob Weinstock became a fan of Davis' Nonet. 46. Davis chose Lewis, trombone player Benny Green, bassist Percy Heath, saxophonist Sonny Rollins, and drummer Roy Haynes. Together they recorded what became a portion of Miles Davis and Horns, 1956. Davis secured further studio dates for other artists in March, June, and September 1951, and had started taking up work transcribing scores for record labels to fund his heroin addiction. The following month, Davis recorded his second session for Prestige as band leader, the material of which was later released on The New Sounds, 1951, Dig, 1956, and Conception, 1956. During his heroin addiction, Davis supported his habit partly with his music and partly by living the life of a hustler, exploiting prostitutes and receiving money from friends. By 1953, his addiction began to impair his playing ability and his drug habit became public in a Downbeat interview with Cab Calloway, whom Davis never forgave as it brought him all pain and suffering. After learning of his father's support, Davis returned to St. Louis and stayed with him for several months to aid his recovery. Though he continued to score heroin out of boredom, Davis caught up with Roach and Mingus in September 1953, who were on their way to Los Angeles for performances. Davis joined them, but the trip caused numerous arguments and problems. Davis returned to his father's home, determined to kick my habit. That was the only thing on my mind. He locked himself inside the guest house and stayed inside for about 7 or 8 days until he had gone through the painful and illness-inducing withdrawals. After the ordeal, Davis sat down and started thinking about how I was going to get my life back together. After kicking his heroin addiction, Davis stayed in Detroit for around 6 months, avoiding New York City where it was easy to score drugs. Though he didn't take heroin during his stay, he was healthy enough to resume live performances in local venues, playing with drummer Elvin Jones and pianist Tommy Flanagan as part of Billy Mitchell's house band at the Bluebird Club. He was also pimping a little at this time. A widely related story, attributed to Richard Prophet Jennings, was that Davis stumbled into Baker's Keyboard Lounge out of the rain, carrying his trumpet in a paper bag under his coat, walked to the bandstand and interrupted Roach and Clifford Brown in the midst of performing Sweet Georgia Brown and played My Funny Valentine before leaving. This is a demo of the Voice Text English TTS system. Davis was supposedly embarrassed into getting clean by this incident. Davis later disputed this account, stating that Roach had invited him to play and that his decision to finally quit heroin was unrelated to the incident, citing his idol boxer Sugar Ray Robinson as an inspiration to get clean and resume his career. In February 1954, a clean Davis returned to New York City, feeling good for the first time in a long time and mentally and physically stronger, and joined a gym. He informed Weinstock and management at Blue Note Records that he was ready to record music with a quintet, which he was granted, and set the task of recording more music than before to make up for lost time. Davis considered two albums with sessions recorded from this time, Miles Davis Quartet, 1954, for Prestige, and Miles Davis Volume 2, 1956, for Blue Note, as very important to him as he felt his performances were particularly strong. Davis was paid roughly $750 for each album he denied to give away all his publishing rights. By now, he had abandoned the bebop style and got to know the musical pianist Ahmad Jamal, whose approach and use of space greatly influenced Davis when Davis returned to the studio in June 1955 to record Miles Davis Quartet and sought a new pianist. He wished for someone who played like Jamal and picked Red Garland. A long youth for the trumpet, which Davis started to use in the mid-1950s. It became a signature sound, and he used it for the rest of his career. Between 1951 and 1954, Davis released many records on Prestige with varied lineups, many with Rollins and Blakey. Such albums include Blue Haze, 1956, Mag's Groove, 1957, Walking, 1957, and Miles Davis and the Modern Jazz Giants, 1959, recorded after Davis' recovery from heroin addiction. They document the evolution of Davis' style and sound, including the fixture of the Harmon mute, also known as a wah-wah mute, onto his trumpet and placed close to the microphone, which became his signature sound, and more spacious, melodic, and relaxed phrasing. Davis assumed the central position in what is known as hard bop, a contrast to bebop, as hard bop included slower tempos and a less radical approach to harmony and melody, often adopting popular tunes and American standards as starting points for improvisation. Hard bop also distanced itself from cool jazz with its harder beat and blues-inspired music. A few critics have named Walking, 1957, the album that created the hard bop genre. In this period, Davis gained a reputation for being distant, cold, and withdrawn, and for having a quick temper. Davis later wrote that in 1954, Leonard was the most important thing in my life besides music, and even took on his arrogant attitude. Factors that contributed to this reputation included his contempt for the critics and specialized press, and some well-publicized confrontations with the public and with fellow musicians. A near fight with Thelonious Monk during the recording of Bang's Groove received wide exposure in the specialized press. In mid-1954, Davis reunited with Gleco for the first time since 1949 after she arrived in New York City for film prospects. The two had been an occasional contact since Davis left Paris. Though Davis was too busy to move to Spain with Gleco, the two remained lovers for many years. Davis had an operation to remove polyps from his larynx in October 1955. Even though he was not supposed to speak at all, he had an argument with somebody and raised his voice. This outburst damaged his vocal cords forever, giving him the characteristic raspy voice that came to be associated with him. It was in February or March 1956 that I had my first throat operation and had to disband the group while recovering. During the course of the conversation, I raised my voice to make a point and fucked up my voice. I wasn't even supposed to talk for at least 10 days, and here I was not only talking, but talking loudly. After that incident, my voice had this whisper that has been with me ever since. The nocturnal quality of Davis playing and his somber reputation, along with his whispering voice, earned him the lasting moniker of Prince of Darkness, adding a patina of mystery to his public persona. 1955 to 1959, signing to Columbia, first Great Quintet, and Modal Jazz. In July 1955, Davis' fortunes improved considerably when he landed a last-minute booking at the second annual Newport Jazz Festival on July 17th, with a lineup of Monk, Keith, drummer Connie Kay, and horn player Zoot Sims and Jerry Mulligan. Davis convinced organizer George Wynn that he should be on the bill, and Wynn complied. The performance was hailed as a triumph by critics and widened Davis' music to the larger affluent white audience, and Davis soon tied first place with Gillespie in the 1955 Downbeat Reader's Poll in the trumpet category. Davis noted that after his set at Newport, things began to happen. Among them was the start of his long-time association with Columbia Records after producer George Avakian saw Davis perform at Newport and wished to sign him. With a year remaining on his Prestige agreement, which required Davis to release four more albums, Davis secured a contract with Columbia which included a $4,000 advance and a condition that his recordings for the label remained unreleased until his Prestige agreement had expired. After recording sessions for Ringus for his newly establishing debut label and a successful gig at Cafe Bohemia with Rollins, Garland, Chambers, and drummer Philly Joe Jones, Davis used this lineup to record his final sessions for Prestige. It took Davis two sessions, held on May 11th and October 26, 1956, to record enough material to fulfill his contract, which was released in a series of four albums, Cooking with the Miles Davis Quintet, 1957, Relicsin' with the Miles Davis Quintet, 1958, Working with the Miles Davis Quintet, 1959, and Skillin' with the Miles Davis Quintet, 1961, each being instrumental in establishing Davis Quintet as one of the best on the scene. In mid-1955, Davis recruited players for what became known as his first great quintet of Garland, Chambers, Jones, and tenor saxophonist John Coltrane, who was chosen after the unsuccessful attempt to recruit Julian Cannonball Adderley. Neither of Davis' picks were widely known at the time, nor had they received a great deal of exposure. The five debuted on record with a widely received around about midnight, 1957, Davis first for Columbia. Their live repertoire included a mix of bebop mainstays, jazz standards from the Great American Songbook and pre-bop eras, and traditional tunes. The prevailing style of the group was a development of the Davis experience in the previous years, Davis playing long, legato, and essentially melodic lines, while Coltrane, who during these years emerged as a leading figure on the musical scene, contrasted by playing high-energy solos. In November 1956, Davis split his quintet temporarily to tour Europe as part of the Birdland All-Stars, formed of himself, the Modern Jazz Quartet, and a lineup of French and German musicians. During his stay in Paris, he reunited with Greco for the first time since 1949. He then returned home, reunited his quartet, and toured the U.S. for 2 months from December 1956. The tour was met with internal friction, however, as Davis had gotten tired of Jones and Coltrane's drug addictions, causing them to turn up late to gigs or at times not at all. Davis, on the other hand, was exercising regularly and consuming alcohol in moderation. Despite the occasional time he would snort a little coke, Davis fired Jones and Coltrane at the tour's end in March 1957 and were replaced by saxophonist Sonny Rollins and drummer R. Taylor. In November 1957, Davis returned to Paris where he recorded the soundtrack to Louis Malle's film Ascenseur pour le Chiffon, 1958. With the aid of French session musicians Arne Weilem, Pierre Michelot, and Rene Erfriger, and American drummer Kenny Clark, the group recorded the score without relying on written material and improvised as they watched the film on the screen in the studio. Davis returned to New York City in December and revived his quintet with a returning Coltrane, now clean from his drug habit, and Adderley. Now a sextet, the group recorded material in early 1958 that was released on Milestones. 1958, an album that first showcased Davis' interest in modal jazz. Davis had witnessed a performance of Les Ballets Africains from Guinea which sparked his interest in such music, the new concept that called for a slower, deliberate pace of music and allowed the creation of solos out of harmony rather than chords. Such music from the ballet featured the kalimba played for long periods of time on a single chord, weaving in and out of consonance and dissonance. By May 1958, Davis had replaced Jones with drummer Jimmy Cobb and faced Garland walking out of the group, leaving Davis to play piano on Sid's Ahead on Milestones. Davis wanted a new pianist who could get into modal jazz, which he found in Bill Evans, a young white musician with a classical background. Evans had a unique, impressionistic approach to the piano, and his musical ideas had a strong influence on Davis. After 8 months of touring, however, Evans was burned out and left in late 1958. He was replaced by Wynton Kelly, who brought a swinging, bluesy approach that contrasted with Evans' more delicate playing. The six made their recording debut on a compilation album, Jazz Track, 1958. 1957 to 1963, collaborations with Gil Evans and Kind of Blue. By early 1957, Davis was exhausted from recording and touring with his quintet and wished to pursue new projects. During a two-week residency in Chicago in March, the 30-year-old Davis told journalists of his intention to retire at its conclusion and revealed offers he had received to become a teacher at Harvard University and a musical director at a record label. Avakian agreed that it was time for Davis to explore something different, but Davis rejected his suggestion of returning to his nonet as he took it as a step backward. Avakian then suggested that Davis work with a bigger ensemble, similar to what he had played on Music for Brass, 1957, an album of orchestral and brass-arranged music led by Gunther Schuller featuring Davis as a guest soloist. This version is strictly for demonstration purposes only. Davis accepted and wished to work with arranger and composer Gil Evans in what became a five-album collaboration from 1957 to 1962. The first, Miles Ahead, 1957, showcased Davis playing the flugelhorn in a rendition of Maids of Cadiz by Leo de Lims, the first piece of European classical music that Davis recorded. Evans devised orchestral passages as transitions between each track were joined together with studio editing, turning each side of the album into a seamless piece of music. Porgy and Bess, 1959, features arrangements of pieces from George Gershwin's opera, which included Chambers, Jones, and Adderley. Sketches of Spain, 1960. Explored Spanish music with tracks by contemporary composers Joaquin Rodrigo and Manuel de Falla with originals from Evans. Recording was met with difficulties as the classical players were unable to improvise to what Evans wished for, and the jazz musicians found the arrangements too difficult. Solia features a 10-minute trumpet solo by Davis. The album was a critical success and sold over 120,000 copies in the U.S. Davis performed with an orchestra conducted by Evans at Carnegie Hall in May 1961 to raise money for charity. The pair's final album was Quiet Nights, 1962, a collection of bossa novas released against their wishes. Evans stated it was only half an album and blamed the record company. Davis blamed producer Dale Nocero and did not speak to him for more than 2 years. Davis noted later that my best friend is Gil Evans. 91, their work was featured in the boxed set Miles Davis and Gil Evans, The Complete Columbia Studio Recordings, 1996, which won a Grammy Award for Best Historical Album and Best Album Notes in 1997. In March and April 1959, Davis recorded what many critics consider his greatest album, Kind of Blue, 1959. Davis named the album to describe its overall mood. He called back Bill Evans, months away from forming what would become his own seminal trio, for the album sessions, as the music had been planned around Evans' piano style. Both Davis and Evans were acquainted with the ideas of pianist George Russell regarding modal jazz. Davis, from discussions with Russell and others before the birth of the Cool Sessions, and Evans from studying with Russell in 1956. Davis, however, had neglected to inform current pianist Wynton Kelly of Evans' role in the recordings. Kelly subsequently played only on the track Freddy Freeloader and was not present at the April dates for the album. So What and All Blues had been played by the sextet at performances prior to the recording sessions, But for the other three compositions, Davis and Evans prepared skeletal harmonic frameworks that the other musicians saw for the first time on the day of recording to allow a fresher approach to their improvisations. The resulting album has proven both highly popular and enormously influential. Released in August 1959, Kind of Blue was an instant success, with widespread radio airplay and rave reviews from critics. It remains the best-selling jazz album of all time. In October 2008, the album reached 4 platinum from the Recording Industry Association of America for selling over 4 million copies in the U.S. alone in 2009. The U.S. House of Representatives voted 409-0 to pass a resolution that honored it as a national treasure. During the success of Kind of Blue, Davis found himself involved with the law.
That's what happens when you're having fun. So we're going to go back and pick it up because I'm going to skip this ad.
On August 25th, 1959, during a recording session at the Birdland nightclub in New York City for the U.S. Armed Services, Davis took a break outside the club. As he was escorting a blonde woman across the sidewalk to a taxi, Davis was told by patrolman Gerald Kilduff to move on. Davis explained that he was working at the club and refused to move. Yet Kilduff proceeded to arrest Davis and grabbed him as Davis tried to protect himself. Witnesses said the patrolman punched Davis in the stomach with his nightstick without provocation. Two detectives held the crowd back, while a third approached Davis from behind and beat him in the head. Davis was arrested and taken to jail, where he was charged for assaulting an officer before he was taken to hospital, where he received 5 stitches. Davis was released on a $525 bail. By January 1960, Davis was acquitted of disorderly conduct and third-degree assault. Davis later stated the incident changed my whole life and whole attitude again, made me feel bitter and cynical again when I was starting to feel good about the things that had changed in this country. Davis supported Kind of Blue with an extended tour with his sextet. He persuaded Coltrane to play with the group on one final European tour in the spring of 1960. Coltrane then departed to form his classic quartet, although he returned for some of the tracks on Davis' album Someday My Prince Will Come, 1961. His front cover features a photograph of his wife at that time, Frances Taylor, after Davis demanded that Columbia depict a black woman on his album covers. By 1961, Edwin magazine estimated Davis was earning as much as $150,000 a year. After Coltrane, Davis tried various saxophonists, including Jimmy Heath, Sonny Stitt, and Hank Mobley. The quintet with Hank Mobley was recorded in the studio and on several live engagements at Carnegie Hall in the Black Hawk Jazz Club in San Francisco. Stitt's playing with the group is found on a recording made in Olympia, Paris, where Davis and Coltrane had played a few months before, and the Live in Stockholm album. In early 1958, Davis began a relationship with Frances Taylor, a dancer whom he had first met in Los Angeles 5 years prior, and they married on December 21, 1960. The relationship involved numerous incidents of Davis' domestic violence towards Taylor. Davis later wrote, "Every time I hit her, I felt bad because a lot of it really wasn't her fault but had to do with me being temperamental and jealous." One reason for his behavior was that by early 1963, Davis had increased his abuse of alcohol and cocaine in an attempt to reduce the pain from his hip and joint pain and discomfort caused from his recent diagnosis of sickle cell anemia. He also experienced hallucinations, looking for this imaginary person in his home to the point of searching the house wielding a kitchen knife. About a week after the photograph for Davis' album ESP, 1965, was taken, Taylor left Davis for the last time. They were
Okay, we're going to stop right here one moment. I don't know where
Mr. Dean is located, because he's not showing up on my board. I don't have a 202 number showing up. He's supposed to be a guest, supposed to be talking about how to start your own business, but I don't see it. So all I can say to you, if you call in, call my phone and let me know that you called in, because I can't see anything here to indicate that you are trying to reach me or that you called into the show. So I expect that if you can hear me, then would you please call me. Let's go on back and finalize this information about the great whomever in terms of I don't know who this particular person is that is actually doing the talking about Miles, but there's some very, very sound information. I see that you call, but evidently I don't see your number up here on my screen. So I don't know why you have not shown up. I don't see that at all. So I don't know. I don't see anything that remotely shows that you are.
Start your show now. Press 1. To hear important instructions, press 2.
It appears that the host has already dialed into the show. Only one host is allowed per show. Thank you for using Blog Talk Radio. Goodbye.
Okay, let me go back. Evidently, what I have done is taken myself out of the show. So let me do this before I can't, because I can't hear anything. Let me go back and play Miles, and because I cannot see anything at all where you are have appeared on the show. If you did call in, I can't see it.
Being separated until they officially divorced in February 1968, 1963 to 1968, second great quintet. Davis performing in anthems, France in July 1963, in December 1962, Davis and his lineup of Kelly, Chambers, Cobb, and Rollins played together for the last time after the first three wished to leave and play as a trio. Rollins left to join them soon after, leaving Davis to pay over $25,000 to cancel upcoming gigs and quickly assemble a new group. Following auditions, he found his new band and tenor saxophonist George Coleman, bassist Ron Carter, pianist Victor Feldman, and drummer Frank Butler, and the five proceeded to record in the studio by May 1963. Feldman and Butler were replaced by pianist Herbie Hancock and the 17-year-old drummer Tony Williams, who made Davis excited all over again. With this group, Davis completed the rest of what became Seven Steps to Heaven, 1963, and recorded the live albums Miles Davis in Europe, 1964, My Funny Valentine, 1965, and For More, 1966. The group.
Okay, what happens here is that this particular person is has been telling you everything in detail about Miles Davis, but we have not heard actually Miles play anything. So I'm going to see if I can pull something up, and so we can see what Miles sounded like during that particular time. Let's see. I don't want to play anything about Bitches Brew, that's for sure. But there's so many people in here who have written things about Miles. Let's see if I can pull something up.
Miles' sound is what I think attracted him most of all to the public. It was a vulnerable sound. The tone of the trumpet for the first time since Louis Armstrong. Everybody between Louis Armstrong and Miles Davis basically came from Louis Armstrong. even though the style may have been such a high style that you'd know him right away and would never think of Louis Armstrong. It could have come out of Roy Elridge, out of Louis Armstrong. But that sound, the timbre, hadn't been changed until Miles did that. He just took all the different players that he liked, went in the funnel and ran out like that and got the sound that he wanted.
Jim Evans required an unusual combination of instruments to create his rich orchestral textures. So some of the best session musicians in New York joined the regular members of Miles' group. One of its last survivors is the drummer Jimmy Cobb.
Everybody wanted to be with Miles. Miles' band, you know, because Miles had the top band, the jazz band in the world, you know, at that time, you know. So every drummer wanted to be there. Miles kind of made me visible, and I can appreciate that, you know. He was the way he wanted to be. You know, he had his technique together, he had his sound together. So, and his enthusiasm, so he was there.
You just heard a various individual playing a bunch of things by Miles. What we're going to do is see if I can find some other things to fill in the remaining of the time. Mr. Dean, I'm sorry, but your phone number didn't appear on my switchboard, so there's no way that I can pull you in. I have to find out exactly how and what you did that you, if you called in, you evidently can hear the show, but it's not showing up here on the switchboard. Where you did get in here. So if you got in, we'll work it out so that next week you will be able to I'll just start the show with you as opposed to us having a time to wait for you to play. So I thought by now I would be able to find some additional stuff about Miles, but it just keeps taking me back to Miles in the past. And I don't really want to go back to Miles way back, way back, way back. I wanted you to hear the great sound that he had in his trumpet. We have about 3 minutes left, and so we're going to see if we can pull up something that will allow me to show you something about how he sounded. What a great sound he had. And what happens is that most of the people that I'm playing right now are people who are actually talking about, and I don't need any more talk. I need some more information concerning him. But being that we can't do it, what I'm going to do is tell you about next week's show because we only have 2 minutes left. Next week, I plan on seeing how we can hook up Mr. Berlin Dean to talk about what he has discovered about starting a business, and so that those of you who are, many of my listeners will have an opportunity to hear what he has to say once we figure out why his telephone number is not showing up on my switchboard. I've had other people tell me that they called in and listened to the show, and for some strange reason, that didn't happen this time. And so what we're going to do is we're going to close out the show with something I sang, and we'll see how that works out. This has been Dr. Dean, and you have been listening to Getting It Done.
The music playing Jesus. How do you keep the song from fading to silence?
Have a good week, people. It's been a pleasure trying to bring you something about Miles. Hopefully next week we'll be able to do that as well as hear something from Mr. Berlin. Take care.